Well, good evening. It is good to be here for the Bible study with you. We are going to cover primarily the book of 2 Samuel this evening, along with the material that is parallel to that in the latter part of 1 Chronicles. The section that we're going through this evening focuses in on David as king. If you remember, in our previous Bible study, we went through and we focused in on David's earlier life, and we looked at basically David's life can be divided into four categories. David the shepherd boy, just a little bit that we learn about him, his early life, David the shepherd boy, David the hero, David the outlaw, and now David the king. He had a lot of ups and downs in his life, spent a goodly portion, let's say most of the decade of his 20s, was spent as David the outlaw. He became king at the age of 30 and reigned for 40 years. And it's that period that we're going to cover this evening. The book of 2 Samuel is almost in its entirety devoted to his kingship and all of the latter part of 1 Chronicles is devoted to his kingship. The kingship of David, of course, is referred to throughout the rest of the Scriptures. And God made covenants with David when Jesus came. The promise was made that he would sit on the throne of his father David. Over and over, there are references to the throne of David and to Christ coming back to that, to ultimately the fact that David himself will be king over all of Israel, and that's reference to that is made particularly in the book of Ezekiel. Now, there are lessons here in this section for the individual. We look at the example of others. The example of King David himself, the example of others who were interacting with David and who played a part in the story. And we, of course, have recorded God's response to the example that was set, the things that occurred. So this section is important both from a standpoint of what we can learn in a personal sense, as well as providing a background for the future history of Israel and for much of prophecy as well. During this section this evening, we began here in 2 Samuel with David's lament for Saul and Jonathan. Then we look at his rulership over Judah, ruling from Hebron. Then he captured Jerusalem and ruled over all of the 12 tribes, over all of Israel. Then we look at the bringing in of the ark to Jerusalem. And God established the covenant with David, the Davidic covenant. The boundaries of the kingdom are extended, established. Then we come to David's sin with Bathsheba, and then Amnon's crime and Absalom's rebellion. David's sin of numbering Israel. Then finally, Adonijah's rebellion and David's charge to Solomon and his death. From a prophetic standpoint, we will take note of 2 Samuel 7 this evening, particularly verses 12 through 16. This is one of the most important sections here in a prophetic standpoint, because God here promises David that his dynasty will go on forever, which obviously looks forward ultimately to the Messiah. We'll note that there is a particular reference in this section that even though some of David's descendants should prove themselves unworthy of the throne, God still would not bring the dynasty to an end. From a personal standpoint, I think one of the greatest lessons that comes here in this section focuses in on David's family situation, the aftermath of his sin with Bathsheba. No matter how deeply repented of a sin may be, there are often physical consequences that are never removed. David it was not a matter that David didn't repent. He certainly did. And Psalm 51 is an outstanding example of what real repentance is. David repented and God forgave him. But the dynamics of what had happened in his family set the stage for problems that we read of through much of the rest of his life. Interaction in terms of his children and all of these various problems that resulted. His conduct, his example, during the years that his children were growing up, produced consequences later on. And that is an important lesson to all of us. You know, no matter how much a person may repent, God may love them very much and forgive them, but that doesn't mean that all the physical consequences are simply done away with. You know, sort of like the story of the prodigal son, the father received him back into the family, received him back as a son. But you know, he had received his inheritance ahead of time, and he had blown it. There's no indication when he came back, the father said, well, we need to divide things up again. Well, no. He had already divided it between the two sons, and this one took his and he blew it. Now, the father was glad to receive him back. He forgave him and he accepted him as a son. But there were physical consequences as a result of something like that, you know, a decision. So it's a lesson to us that, you know, the best thing is to do what God says to begin with, because then there are benefits and blessings that come automatically. It's not a matter that you can't learn a lesson by experience. It's not a matter that God won't forgive you. But it is a matter that there will often be heartache, and in many cases involving others, impacting the lives of others, depending, you know, in a context where you're looking at a family situation, then you've got children and others that are automatically brought in. So there are lessons there. You know, the world views sin in a totally backward way. The world views sin as all the stuff that's fun, and God doesn't like people to have fun. I mean, that's sort of the typical religious view, you know, certainly that the Catholic Church has fostered, and the idea that you know, it's all the things that'd be a lot of fun, but God has sort of a dreary sense of humor, and He doesn't like people to do much. Well, that is totally distorted. God's law is always for our good. There's nothing God tells me to do that I'm going to be better off not doing. And there's nothing He tells me not to do that I'm going to be better off if I go ahead and do it anyway. It just, you know, doesn't work that way. But it's as though that's a hard thing for us to get across. You know, one of the things that certainly stands out here in 2 Samuel, in terms of the very beginning of the book, we're introduced to the David's response to the death of Saul. Now, you know, this young man that came back, that this Amalekite that came to tell the news to David. You know, you can just tell that he just figured David was going to jump up and down and clap his hands and be so glad that Saul was dead. But you know, David didn't hate Saul. David did his best to stay out of Saul's way. David had opportunities, as we saw last time, he had opportunities to kill him. In spite of everything that Saul did, David never became bogged down he never became obsessed with Saul and just bogged down in hatred and resentment for Saul. Where, boy, I'm glad he got his. You know, David recognized the danger from Saul, and he did his best to stay out of the way and avoid the circumstance. It was a very difficult situation. But David genuinely, he regarded Saul's office, and he took that very seriously. I think it's something to show us. You know, we're told that David was a man after God's own heart. I think it's good for us as we go through the life of David to try to notice what are the attributes of David's character that God was so impressed with. Obviously, there were some serious mistakes David made. That wasn't what God was so pleased with or impressed with. But there were things that God was very took great note of. God said that David was a man after his own heart. I think clearly one of the things that God appreciated and valued in David was his loyalty. Was the loyalty that he had, and the loyalty to sense of office here. Well, the story, of course, is that this Amalekite who came down, and there, some of the commentators try to make a deal out of it, because the story is told in the end of 1 Samuel, and what's told in the beginning of 2 Samuel gives two different accounts of how Saul died. In 2 Samuel, the Amalekite takes the credit for finishing him off. I think the most likely part of the story is the Amalekite figured that there was going to be a reward in it for him. He figured that I'm gonna really be an important fella. I'm gonna come in there and I'm gonna tell him I finished the king off, and I don't know what the reward is, but I bet it's gonna be a good one. You can just see him. He evidently came by, saw things. I think that's the most likely explanation. The other possibility is that Saul fell on his sword and didn't actually kill himself. But I think in my mind, it's so typical of human nature. The Amalekite wanted the credit. And he found out that instead of the credit, he got the blame. David said, "How is it that you weren't afraid to lift up your hand against the Lord's anointed?" It was not... anyway, David did not take that at all as a... it was a good thing. In fact, the man was executed. So David, we're told in verse 17 of chapter 1, this is in 2 Samuel, David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. And he bade them teach the children of Judah. I think the reference here is, and this is written, mentions the book of Jasher. This was obviously an ancient secular record that the writer of 2 Samuel appealed to. It was, at the time the story was written, this was something that was widely known, and he quoted his reference source. The book of Jasher, of course, has long since disappeared. There are about three or four books that claim to be the book of Jasher. If you look them up, look up that in the encyclopedia, you'll find that I think the oldest of those dates back to about 1000 A.D., and there are about three or four different sources that are just... any book that is mentioned in the Bible that has disappeared, somebody has made at least one forged copy, and put that name on it. That's a good way to sell books. And that's been around, that sort of thing's been around for a long time. But it's just simply a reference, a quotation. Jasher was never intended to be a part of the Bible. If it was, it'd be here. God preserved what he wanted in the Bible, but you realize, these books were read thousands of years ago too. See, it was a historical book that gave the story of the kingship, and this was an ancient reference source that people could be referred to and go back and read certain accounts of the story. So it gives this lament that David did, and it was something that he ordered that it would be set it to music. And it was a song that came to be sung. David took it very seriously. And obviously God was pleased with David's attitude and David's response. There are warnings in Proverbs about not rejoicing when you see your enemy, have a problem. So God may look down and notice, how much, what a good time you're having, and all of a sudden he may lighten up on the enemy, and you may get a little of it. Just sort of take it in stride, and don't be out trying to rejoice in the calamity of another. And David certainly was an outstanding example in that regard. In chapter 2, David goes up to Hebron, and this is the David becomes is the king here of Judah, and Hebron is his capital, and verse 11. David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah 7 years and 6 months. Now what we find is that one of Saul's sons, Ishbosheth, was taken by Abner and was made king. And he ruled over the other tribes. And Ishbosheth at this time was 40 years old. And this gives us, by the way, a little bit of insight. Ishbosheth was a younger son of Saul. Jonathan was the crown prince. Ishbosheth was 40 at this time. David was 30. So we know that Jonathan was, let's say, a minimum of perhaps 15 years older than David. There was a they were not exactly the same age. They were. Let's say at the time David killed Goliath, when he was maybe in his late teens, maybe let's say 17 or 18, somewhere in that neighborhood. Jonathan was probably in his early to mid-30s, because his younger brother was 10 years older than David, and we're not told, you know, Saul had several wives, so you can't necessarily go just by the number of children that he had, but the indication would certainly be that Jonathan was at least a few years older than this particular brother. Well, we find here that there was rivalry, there was trouble between, of course, the house of Saul there that was ruling over Israel and the house of Judah, and the story is told here. In chapter 2 about Joab, who was David's relative, and who was a very who was the commander of the Israelite of the army under David, and Abner, who had been the commander of Saul's army. And what you find is that Abner and Joab ran into each other on a particular occasion. And they sort of had a pitched battle, not with the whole army, but they picked out 12 men on each side, and they fought to a draw. They just got out there and went to it, and so it describes that here. And then there was a battle, and after in the aftermath of that, and Abner was beaten, and it describes the. Three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, and two of his brothers. And what we find is that one of Joab's brothers, was a very quick runner, Azahel. And he pursued after Abner. And he was running him down. He was going to catch him. And Abner told him, he said, "You better stop." He said, "I hate to kill you, but I am if you keep coming." And Azahel wouldn't turn aside. And so Abner killed him. And Abner managed to get away. And Joab was very upset about this. He was Joab, as you'll go through the story, was an exceptional man. He had tremendous ability. He was in many ways very loyal to David. Had great ability as a general, but he was hard-headed as he could be. You couldn't tell him anything. He was going to do it his way. He was convinced his way was the best, and he was going to do it his way, even when the king told him to do it another way. If he was convinced his way was the best, he just went ahead and did it his way. And it eventually, by the time you get to the end of the story, it landed him in trouble. This is shown right here that... there was war, we're told in chapter 3, between the house of Saul and the house of David. David waxed stronger and stronger. The house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. Talks about the children of David that were born there in Hebron. And we find that Abner had Ishbosheth, Saul's son, who was king, that was evidently sort of jealous and maybe a little bit fearful of Abner, accused him of having taken his father's concubine. And Abner was very upset, and he just told him, he said, well, you know, he says, you're going to you're going to lose the whole thing, you know, that David's going to be king over this whole thing. You're going to be out of job. Well, Abner was afraid, didn't say anything else. He was afraid, Abner, but Ishbosheth was afraid, wouldn't answer Abner because he was afraid. And Abner sent messages to message to King David and said, want to make an agreement, want to... David said, well, I'm not going to even talk to you until you bring my wife back, Michal, the daughter of Saul. You know, he took her away from me. She was my wife, took her away and gave her to somebody else. And I'm not even going to talk to anybody from your side until you bring her back. And so the upshot of the story was, of course, that Abner came to David, verse 20, to Hebron, 20 men with him. And they had a big feast. And Joab, when Joab came in there, verse 24, he was upset. He told King David, he said, Abner was here and you let him get away. Why didn't you do something? Why you should have finished him off. And he's just here to trick you, and I don't trust him. Joab, of course, was still holding a grudge because Abner had killed his brother. Well, the story, as you come on down, Joab goes out there and sort of entices Abner over and says, hey, I got something I need to talk to you real privately about. When they get over there, old Joab just pulls out this dagger, and before Abner knows what's doing, he's dead. He stabs him right there. And David was upset about this, and what had done, commanded that the nation show respect to Abner by putting on a state funeral, and everybody had to go in mourning, and he required Joab to be a part of this. And so he says he told Joab, he says, you're gonna get it for this sort of thing. Well, when Saul's son, chapter 4, heard that Abner was dead in Hebron, his hands were feeble and all the Israelites were troubled. And he was nervous about this whole thing. And as we come on down through the story, we find that some of Ishbosheth's servants. Ishbosheth was taking a nap during the middle of the day. This is chapter 4, verse 5. And there in the middle of his house, here his servants came in here and killed him, murdered him, assassinated him. And they made a getaway, and they cut his head off. It was a gruesome murder. They stabbed him, and they cut his head off and brought his head to David. You know, evidently they hadn't heard the story of the first guy that had done a stunt like this. They thought that, you know, this was really going to put them in good. David was really going to be impressed with them. And David told him, he said, when one told me, verse 10, that Saul is dead, thinking he brought me good tidings, I took hold of him and slew him in Ziklag. He thought that I was going to give him a reward. Now, how much more? When wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his own bed. He said, you know, I didn't put up with it when this Amalekite did this to Saul. You sneak up on this man. He's laying in his bed in his house, minding his own business. You sneak in there and assassinate him. He trusts you. You're his servants. You do something like that. You think, I want people like that working for me? You know, I mean, just think of it even in practical terms. You want the British paid Benedict Arnold, but they never gave him a command in the British Army. They never trusted him. He was a traitor. They figured, they were smart enough to figure, if he'll sell out his original side, then obviously he's got a price. He'll sell us out. We don't trust him. We'll buy somebody like that if we need them, but we don't trust them. And David looked at this and he think, why would I want somebody like this over here with me? These are the kind of guys that sneak up on you in the middle of the night and they stab you. So he took care of that. David commanded his young men, verse 12, and they slew them. That solved that. And Ishbosheth's head that had been brought there was taken back and buried there at the tomb of Abner there in Hebron. And so now all the tribes of Israel come to David to Hebron. Notice how David was willing to accept God's time on things. For years after he was anointed king, first he became a hero. Well, that was good. That looked like maybe God's working things out. Then he became an outlaw, and that dragged on for probably close to 10 years. And it dragged on and on and on, and he didn't know how long it was going to last, and then Saul died. But he didn't become king over all of Israel. Now he was reigning in Hebron, reigning over Judah. And 7.5 years went by. That's a long time. And, finally now, on God's timing, the whole kingdom has come to it. He was prepared to wait on God. He was 30 years old when he began to reign, verse 4, and he reigned 40 years. He was 7 years and 6 months in Hebron and reigned 33 years in Jerusalem over the whole nation. Now, the king and his men went up to Jerusalem, which was in the hand of the Jebusites. And they, actually Jerusalem at that point, was what later became called the City of David. It was the Jebusite citadel, and it was very well protected. It was sort of like a little castle or fortress up there. That was the, and they said, "Why, you'll never get up here. Why, we can defend this with the lame and the blind, and David can't come up." Well, David took it. What we find is you put the story together from here in 2 Samuel 5, as well as in 1 Chronicles 11. 1 Chronicles 11, verse 6, tells part of the rest of the story. What we find is that Joab was the first man into Jerusalem. Joab had a lot, a lot going for him in that sense. He was an excellent warrior. He was loyal and dedicated in his own way, but he was stubborn and hard-headed. And that ultimately proved to be his undoing. But evidently what they did was he discovered this gully, this area, where he climbed up into the... climbed up like this well shaft that carried up through what was the means by which water was gotten into the city. And he was evidently quite an athlete and managed to work his way up through this tight enclosure. And once he got up there and got in the city, then he was able to open the gates up. Everybody came in, and the fortress wasn't fortified anymore. It was wide open. So it was now called the City of David, this section of it. And verse 11 of chapter 5, Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David, and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. There was a friendship that was developed here with Hiram, king of Tyre, that came on down to his son Solomon. Tyre was, of course, the Phoenician capital, and the Phoenicians were quite a renowned people when it came to trading and sailing and also certain building trades. So this describes this situation here. And the things that continued on. Now, as we come on down through the story, in chapter 6, David gathered together the chosen men of Israel, and they went with all the people that were with him. They went to bring from thence the Ark of God. The Ark was being brought. It was in the house of Abinadab in Gibeah. And you can read that story back here in when you read about in 1 Samuel. You remember the story that we went through early on of where the Philistines captured the Ark. Phinehas and the Ark, from the days of Moses, the Ark had reposed in the Holy of Holies, in the tabernacle. But Phinehas and Hophni, the sons of Eli, took the Ark out of the Holy of Holies and carried it out to battle. Well, the Philistines captured it. Evidently, as far as the account is laid out, the Ark never again resided in the Holy of Holies. Never after the day after Phinehas and Hophni carried it out, it never was back inside the tabernacle. The Philistines captured it. Then the Philistines tried to give it back, and you remember the story. And they finally moved it down there to this house of Abinadab, and it stayed there now for quite a number of years, for for Samuel, the period of Saul's reign, and down here to this part of David's, and much of Samuel's early administration, probably close to 100 years, it had been there. Now, after David has captured Jerusalem, he's going to bring the Ark down to Jerusalem. And they build a tabernacle or a tent for the Ark. But the tabernacle itself remains up at Gibeah. And that's where Solomon later goes, you know, at the beginning of his reign, to go up there to the tabernacle. So anyway, they bring this ark down, but there is a problem. They don't follow the instructions. You know, nobody thought to look and pay attention to what was done. They loaded it in a cart. Well, there were specific instructions. In fact, there were poles that were built that were. The ark was to be carried on the shoulders of four Levites, there were rings that were put in the corners of the ark. There were poles that went through, and the ark was to be transported in a particular way. And nobody was to touch the ark. It was sacred. It was symbolic of the very presence of God. And so they're bringing in the They're bringing the ark out of the house of Abinadab, which was in Gibeah, and they're coming along the way, and they're playing music, and they're celebrating, and they got here to Nacon's threshing floor, and the ark evidently wobbled here on this cart, and a man by the name of Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark. He reached out and touched it to steady it, and he was smitten. He died right there by the ark. And David was upset, and everybody, they didn't know what was going on. And David was afraid of God and afraid to move the ark, and they carried it there to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, and it remained there 3 months. And during that time, God blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. And so David then goes down to bring the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And they bore the ark. This time they did it right. They went 6 paces and they sacrificed oxen and fatlings. And they had this celebration. You know, they were very careful about bringing it in this time. And what we find is that... you know, this terrible tragedy as far as what happened to Uzzah really goes back to the fact that the leaders involved didn't follow the instructions. They did not take the time and the trouble to go back and carefully research the specifics as to what should have been done. Things had really, you have to realize how things had gotten really sort of off the track in Israel, certainly during Saul's reign. The priests weren't doing the things they were supposed to do, and things had just drifted. Obviously, they weren't teaching the law, and there should have been somebody there, should have been one of the priests who knew what to do and should have instructed David and showed him in the scriptures what the instructions were when this thing first came up. But it wasn't. And so this really got their attention. And they brought in the ark, verse 17, set it in its place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. And David offered, there's reference in the scripture, you read about the tabernacle of David, which was different than the tabernacle that Moses had made. And so for a period of time, there were actually two tabernacles. There was a tabernacle of David there in the area of Jerusalem where the ark was, and there was the tabernacle that Moses had made that was back there where all the other articles of furniture were, and everything except the ark. And so there were actually two locations, and it was in the beginning of Solomon's reign when the temple was completed that they went back and they took the ark down. The priests who were there at Gibeon, where the tabernacle was, that they brought all of that down to the temple, and then they brought the ark into the temple, and everything was consolidated once again. So David, when all of this is over and they have celebrated and everything, and people all went home, David came into the house, and Michal, his wife, Saul's daughter, had been watching out of the window, and she was in a very spiteful attitude and made some very sarcastic comments about David's celebration. He was sort of dancing a Highland fling on the way down the road, you know, and there was quite a celebration going on, and Michal makes some very sarcastic comments about that. And so what we're told is that Michal never had any children, that she was childless, and very likely David, it seemed like that was just sort of a rift between them in the aftermath of that. Well, the king came, sat in his house, chapter 7, and the Lord gave him rest round about from all his enemies. And, God, he had triumphed over the enemies. The borders of the nation were expanded out to the borders that God had promised. And David began to think about it, and it began to strike him, I'm living in a nice house. I'm living in a permanent dwelling. I'm living in a house of cedar, chapter 7, verse 2. But the ark of God dwells with curtains. That didn't seem quite right. The ark is dwelling in a tent, and I'm living in a nice house. And so he talked to Nathan about it. Nathan said, it sounds good to me. That's reasonable. Well, that night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan and said, now, you need to go back and straighten things out with David, because this is not... not the matter. God appreciated David's attitude and all of that, but he was not going to have David build the house of God. Notice here in verse 8, chapter 7, verse 8, you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the sheepcote, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people, over Israel. It's sort of interesting. In several places, God uses the term shepherd to describe the king. Clearly, there was a connection between ruling the nation and shepherding the flock that God took as a very important connection, because that is the metaphor, the term that is used in the Old Testament and in the New. The word pastor. Anywhere you read pastor in the New Testament, it comes from a Greek word that simply means shepherd. It's when it refers to Christ, the chief shepherd, when he shall appear. This is the term that is used. You read references in the Old Testament. You know, the king this connection. So clearly that's an important connection that God makes. God tells David, verse 9, or tells Nathan to tell him, I was with you whithersoever you went. I've cut off all your enemies out of your sight. I've made you a great name, like unto the name of the great men that are in the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I'll plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time. And as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel and have caused you to rest from all your enemies, also the Lord tells you that He will make you a house. When your days be fulfilled and you shall sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you which shall proceed out of your bowels, and I will establish His kingdom. I'll build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I'll be his father, and he'll be my son. If he commit iniquity, I'll chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. Your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. These are the words, according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak to King David. And notice here, God said, I will build you a house, I'll establish your throne. And then he made plain the fact that what if some of David's descendants didn't follow things as they ought? He said, well, I'll be like a father to them. And if they commit iniquity, I'll chasten them. I will punish them. I'm not saying that they'll get by without punishment. But I'm not going to remove my mercy from them as I took it away from Saul. I eliminated the house of Saul from ruling over Israel. Just eliminated it. I'm not going to do that with your dynasty. I'll establish a dynasty that's going to extend forever, because it will extend forever because Jesus Christ was born of the seed and lineage of David as a human being, and so he's going to rule forever. He's going to he is going to take that throne when he returns. But it's made very plain here that there is a distinction between how God dealt with Saul and how he would deal with the family of David. And so David responded to what God said. Now we have in chapter 8 the story of how David expanded out the borders of Israel and the various things that he had done, how he subdued Assyria and Ammon and Moab and Edom and put actual garrisons of troops that the border was extended, verse 3, all the way to the river Euphrates. And so this is, spread out in that way to the ancient borders that were promised. And verse 15, David ruled over all of Israel, and he executed judgment and justice upon all his people. So it describes here the setup that they had. Now, chapter 9 gives a little insight into David's character. David asks, is there any that's left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? And we find that there was a servant was called, and he knew and told David about a son of Jonathan by the name of Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was crippled. He had evidently been dropped as a child when they were fleeing. And he was lame in his feet. He was crippled. So David showed them honor and respect, had Mephibosheth dwell in Jerusalem and eat continually at the king's table. He was a very welcome guest. And then the chapter 10 describes a story the king of Ammon had died, and David wanted to show respect, and so he sent some servants there to the land of Ammon to represent him at the temple. Well, the princes of Ammon were pretty stupid. They looked at this, and they sort of resented David, resented the power of Israel, and they said, well, we think he sent these fellows up here to spy it out. And so they humiliated them. They got them out there, and they cut their robes off, and they cut off part of their beard, and they just made them look ridiculous, and said, well, you know, we'll show you, and we're going to send them back. Well, when David heard about it, he was very upset at the idea that something like that would be done. And in the meantime, Assyria and Ammon had made an alliance. Well, David, we find that Joab came up here with battle with the army, and ultimately David came out, gathered all Israel together, passed over the Jordan, came there and defeated the Syrians, and they were the end of the story is in verse 19. The Syrians feared to help the children of Ammon anymore. That sort of broke them from the habit of getting involved in something like this. And chapter 11 now begins this one of the famous accounts of the life of David, and that is the situation with Bathsheba. David had not gone out to battle. He had stayed in Jerusalem, and the army was off, and you remember the story. You know, one evening David was there on the roof of the king's house, and he saw Bathsheba taking a bath, and he was very attracted to her, found out who she was, and you know, this compounded it, because when you go back to the accounts in Chronicles, you find that not only was he was told who it was. Well, this is the daughter of Eliam. Well, Eliam was one of his mighty men. Uriah the Hittite was one of his mighty men, one of his chief soldiers. This was when he found out who it was. Here's somebody that is directly connected to people that have high offices of trust with David. But he was enamored with her, and sent and asked for her to come over to the palace. And there's no indication that she was at all hesitant to do that. She came right over, and the aftermath of the matter was that she became pregnant, and then sent word back to David to let him know what had happened. I think it's interesting in Psalm 51, one of the most striking things, the natural tendency of human beings is to make excuses and to try to blame somebody else. I mean, you find that starting right back in the beginning of Genesis. That's the natural tendency. You put somebody on the spot, you catch them doing something they shouldn't do, and they start telling you why it wasn't all their fault, and you know, I mean, you work with people on jobs. Isn't that basically what happens? You know, it's not all my fault. You don't understand. Psalm 51 reflects such a totally different attitude. David didn't make a single excuse. I think that's the heart and essence of repentance. You know, when somebody comes in with a whole list of excuses and why it really wasn't their fault and somebody else ought to get in a little trouble too, they obviously have not come to repentance. That's not what repentance is. You know, David could have started complaining, well, and you know, why was she out there? You know, if David could see Bathsheba, couldn't Bathsheba see David? Have you ever noticed that? You know, if you can see someone, they can see you. That's normal. You know, if there's line of vision connection between the roofs of the two houses, he could see her. Well, she must have. You know, there's no indication she just moved in that house the day before. She knew that she was right near the king's palace. There was nobody in Jerusalem that didn't have a clue. I don't know where the king lives, you know. Well, they knew where the king lived. And you know, so obviously she was not opposed to being seen by the king, and she wasn't opposed to being invited to come spend the night at the palace. And but you don't find where David ever used that as an excuse as to why it wasn't his fault. He never mentions that. You can read through Psalm 51, no allusion to the fact of, well, I was tricked, or it was her fault, or whatever it was. Well, the result, of course, now David panics. You know, it's one thing to do something, and of course you expect to get by with it. Now, he is about to be caught in a terrible scandal, and he is scared. And the thought of the scandal and the humiliation and everything. And so now he does it worse, you see. People get scared, they panic, and they're going to solve the problem their own way. And he thinks, well, I know what I'll do. I'll get Joab to send Uriah back here to make a report. He'll go home, spend the night with his wife, and then when she has the baby, there'll be no way to, you know, I mean, difference of a few weeks, baby can come early, and you know, he'll assume that it's his. Everybody else will. I'll be off the hook. Well, Uriah was a hard-headed fella, and he had a certain sort of warrior's code, and he wasn't going to go home and sleep in his own bed while all the troops were out sleeping on the ground. And so he wouldn't do it. And David tried everything he knew. He thought, well, he'd get the guy so drunk that he wouldn't know where he was, and then they'd get him back down there. Uriah wouldn't go. Well, now David is really in a jam. Uriah never went home. Never went to, you could get off into a lot of speculation in that regard as to the various things about the marriage that Uriah and Bathsheba had, and things that you might derive from that, and maybe she was lonely and frustrated, and Uriah maybe wasn't the world's greatest husband. There are a lot of things you can get into, so you can come up with all sorts of excuses that people use and rationalize in their minds. And I'm sure they did. I mean, isn't that what we generally do when we do something we shouldn't? We somehow rationalize it as to why, well, it wasn't real bad and this and that, because somehow we have to live with ourselves, you see. I mean, your alternative is you either rationalize your sin or you repent of it, or else you go absolutely nuts. Because guilt will drive you crazy. You either have to, well, rationalize it doesn't solve it. It becomes sort of a little mental game. You know, it's like what John says in 1 John. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth isn't in us. I think that's generally the way people say they have no sin. They rationalize it. They excuse it, justify their behavior by this or that. And John says, if you do that, you're deceiving yourself. You're just playing a game. You're not really getting out from under guilt. You may be getting where you can sort of live with some compromise in your mind. The only way to get out from under guilt is to repent. Then God removes the guilt. And it's gone. Well, you know the story. David panics here. He doesn't know what else to do that he can figure out. He's in a mess. So he sends a note to Joab and he says, put Uriah in the forefront of the battle. Then withdraw troops back. And of course, the result was Uriah was killed. Now, Joab did that. There's no indication that, there's nothing said about that Joab told anybody else about this. He followed through what David told him to do. And this, of course, Uriah was dead, and David, of course, took Bathsheba as his wife. And he thought, well, everything's all covered up. Nobody will ever know. Well, you know, how many servants, you know, he sent a servant over to get her and bring her to the palace. How many servants did she pass coming in? They could count back then the way they can now, and when she came up and had this baby, you know, maybe 6.5 months or so after she and David were married, as you put the story together, I think it must have been somewhere, you know, 6.5, 7 months. Had to have been at least a couple of months that went by, because long enough she knew she was pregnant for them to get Uriah, bring him back and forth, and then had to wait a few days to get him buried and sort of all this. So, you know, people had it all figured out. You can rest assured all the servants in the palace had been whispering around. They knew what was going on. They had seen this thing. They had it all figured out. David thought he had really covered it up. You know, nobody will find out. Well, it was probably the scuttlebutt of Jerusalem, because if the servants knew in the palace, well, they had relatives and friends and, you know, people that they gossiped with outside the palace. And so undoubtedly word had circulated all around. People were buzzing, but nobody obviously said anything in the king's presence. One day Nathan came into the palace, chapter 12, and of course he tells this story to elicit a response from David, and David is just indignant that somebody would have taken advantage of his wealth and power to take advantage of someone like that. Oh, he stirred up. And Nathan looks him in the eye and points his finger at him and says, "You, O king, are that man." Well, obviously you can hear a pin drop in the palace, in the throne room. You know, everybody's looking, wondering what's going to happen next. And I think one of the remarkable things that it shows here, David took the correction. You know, it takes humility to take correction. And particularly now David is humiliated in front of everybody around. Nathan confronts him here. And evidently, normally when he comes with him, he comes before him with a case for judgment. Well, in a situation like that, the king is normally had certain hours when he was in the throne room, when he received those who came in to him, when he listened and he made decisions. So you had the important people of the realm standing there in the room as judgment was pronounced. Here was an audience that was there. And David now has everything brought out into the open that had been done undercover. Of course, people had pretty well figured it out. Word must have been going around. But Nathan confronts him. Now, you go through the account of the kings and you find particularly once some of the kings were sort of ensconced in power and position, when somebody came to them and confronted them with correction, it made them mad. One of the things that tends to come with power is pride. Wealth and power in most people engenders pride. And correction takes humility. It takes a very humble person to accept correction. And I think this was certainly a test of David's character. He had done a terrible thing. Allowed himself to get, enticed by his lust, and then he'd gotten scared of the consequences and he tried to cover it up. And he allowed that to drive him to do horrible things. Now he's confronted with it. And yet you find, and you put this account in 2 Samuel 12 together with the account with Psalm 51, and you see what David's attitude was. David really began to seek God, and so the result, of course, was that the child that was born died, and there was another child that was born later, and that child was Solomon. That's mentioned in verse 24. And as we come on down to chapter 13, we begin to see a little more some of the consequences, what was going on in David's family. Describes a son of David by the name of Absalom. And he had a sister whose name was Tamar. David, of course, had children by a variety of women. So these were half-brothers and half-sisters. And Amnon, who was one of David's sons, a half-brother to Absalom and Tamar, became enamored with Tamar. And he wanted his half-sister. And so he moped and pined around and finally got this thing that he decided that, you know, what he was going to do is just take to bed. He was sick. And when the king inquired and was worried about him, he'd say, well, why don't you send my sister Tamar over here to fix some food for me? And so that, of course, is what happened. And when Tamar got in there, and just the two of them, then he tried to get her to come to bed with him, and she resisted, and he grabbed her and forced it. And then in the aftermath of that, we're told in verse 14, he wouldn't hearken to her voice. She tried to persuade him, not talk him out of it, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. Well, in the aftermath of that, he was mad. She hadn't responded the way he thought she would, and now he hated her. He was furious. He drove her out. Well, the story, of course, is that she went back to her brother, to Absalom, and told him what had happened. And David heard about it, verse 21. He was very wroth. He was upset. But there's no indication he really did anything about it. And Absalom just simply didn't speak to Amnon didn't say anything to him, but he hated him. And time went by, 2 full years. And Absalom, came, 2 years had gone by, and Absalom pressed and wanted Amnon to, and all the rest of the king's sons, he wanted to have a party down there where he was shearing sheep. And he persuaded David to insist that all the brothers go down there. And, of course, the result was they got him down there to kill Amnon. Absalom had harbored this grudge for 2 years. And the result was that he killed Amnon. And then Absalom fled. And he was gone. He fled out of the country. And this went on for 3 years. So now we're 5 years after this event between Amnon and Tamar. Absalom stayed hidden for 3 years or fled to another country. David grieved for him. It really bothered him, and he grieved about the situation. And Joab finally took things into his hands. He could see David was unhappy, and he works out sort of this stratagem to sort of trick David into confronting it. Evidently, it was something David didn't want to talk about, and Absalom or Joab sort of brought it to a head, and the king called Absalom. Well, Absalom was brought back, and verse 28, he dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and didn't see the king's face. Now, this thing has dragged on now 7 years since the incident with Tamar and Amnon. King finally lets him come back, but he can't follow through and be reconciled. And so Absalom is there 2 years, and he doesn't see the king. And Joab, well, you can't say Joab won't return his phone calls because he didn't have phones, but Joab just was sort of keeping his distance. Absalom sent for Joab, verse 29, to have sent him to the king. Wanted him to be the mediator, but Joab wouldn't come to him. He sent again the second time, he wouldn't come. So he said, I'll get him to come. Joab had a field of grain down there that bordered on some property Absalom had, so they set fire to Joab's property. Well, that got old Joab stirred up. Boy, he came looking for Absalom then. And Absalom said, I've been sending a message. Been leaving a message. You wouldn't return my phone calls. I see you did this time. There are ways. I don't recommend that as being the best way to get somebody to return your call, but that was what happened. So anyway, now Absalom or Joab came to the king and sort of laid the whole thing out, and the king agreed, and he called for Absalom, and now Absalom is reconciled. But see, Absalom now is really, all this time has gone by and all the things that have happened, Absalom has nursed a major resentment against his father. And so they're not really reconciled. Absalom, chapter 15, verse 1, prepared chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. He rose up early and he stood beside the way of the gate. When any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, Absalom called and he said, Where are you from? They'd tell him, and he said, "Boy, you know, you sure got a good cause." Verse 3, you got a real good case. It's too bad the king isn't better organized. He ought to have a man deputized out here to hear your case. You're standing in this long line? Boy, it's really too bad. Verse 4, Absalom said, "Oh, I wish I were judge in the land. Every man that had a suit or cause could come to me, and I'd do him justice." You know, it just really grieves me to see all you folks having such a hard time, and I'm trying to get the king to let me help him out, and he won't do it. And when anybody came near to him to do obeisance, verse 15, he put out his hand, you know, he shook hands and kissed them and told them, "Oh no, you know, don't bow down to me." He was sort of a populist, sort of a man of the people, see. And so this is what Absalom did. And we're told, verse 6, Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. That the 40 years it mentions in verse 7 is evidently... Absalom was evidently the one who was 40. He wanted to go to Hebron for a vow. The king didn't realize what was going on. Absalom, of course, had this conspiracy hatched. Absalom was going to overthrow the king. He was going to have himself proclaimed king. You know, I think it's important as you go through these accounts and you read, is it understandable why Absalom nursed a grudge? Is it understandable why Absalom had a resentment? Sure it is. But what was the result of it? You know, you look through the story and you read about the people who nursed grudges and held resentments. And you read it and you can look at it from their standpoint, and it's understandable why they felt hurt, why they felt angry, why they felt resentful about someone or something. You can understand, why did Joab feel resentful about Abner? Well, Abner killed his brother. Of course, when you looked at the whole story, the brother had sort of asked for it, you know. There's a little more to it. But Joab resented Abner, and when he got a chance, he assassinated him. Absalom resented Amnon. Very understandable. Amnon had raped his sister. He nursed a grudge for 2 years until he got the chance and he murdered Amnon. Well, then that really disrupted his life. He was fled. He was in hiding 3 years. Then finally, things worked out for him to come back. He was still estranged from his father. David just couldn't seem to get over this thing of one of his sons having killed the other. And finally, that comes to a head, and the father and son are sort of reconciled and began to have contact. But now Absalom is nursing such a deep resentment and hostility toward his father, the way his father's handled this situation, that he takes time. We're not told exactly how long, but he sort of prepares the way. You get the idea this dragged on for a period of time, you know, because he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And he conspired against his father. And of course, as you come on down through the story, you find that one of the ones who joined him when this thing was Ahithophel. So they told David in verse 31 that Ahithophel was among the conspirators with Absalom. Ahithophel was David's closest friend. He was is referenced in a couple of the Psalms is my own familiar friend, with whom I ate bread. But Ahithophel, when you put the whole story together, was Bathsheba's grandfather. He was the father of Eliam. Bathsheba was the daughter of Eliam, and Ahithophel was the grandfather. So evidently Ahithophel had nursed a grudge for years. Nursed a resentment, but he put on a front when he was around David. David didn't know there was a problem. But you read, of people holding grudges, nursing resentments. And you see, sooner or later, here's the thing, if you nurse a resentment, sooner or later a circumstance will present itself, and that resentment will go from being in the background to jumping to the forefront. Here were people who jumped on the bandwagon of rebellion against King David because they'd been nursing resentments, and they hadn't, they weren't in a position to do anything about it, so they just nursed the resentments. But the time came when they thought they were in a position to get even. Man, we can get him now. And so you read of all sorts of people who jumped on the bandwagon. They were ready to do that. There's an important lesson for all of us to learn, because none of us, I don't care what anybody has done, none of us can afford to hold a resentment against anybody. There's some folks that had some pretty good excuses. If you want an excuse for a resentment, when you read this story, you can find folks that had pretty good excuses. I dare say most of us have held resentments with less excuse than what some of these had. But what did it do to them? What did it do to their spiritual health, to their relationship with God, and to what did it do in the ultimate end of their lives? Well, all it did was bring grief and trouble. Well, the story. The king didn't want Jerusalem. Didn't want Jerusalem destroyed. Here in a battle, and he hears that Absalom has put together this huge army, and so he says, we better flee. I don't want to fight it out in Jerusalem. And so he takes the household and he flees, and they pass over the brook Kidron, and verse 24, Zadok and all the Levites come bearing the ark of God. And the king told Zadok, verse 25, you carry the ark back to the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he'll bring me again, show me both it and his habitation. But if he say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here am I. Let him do to me as seems good unto him. And so it's interesting, David's attitude. You see, as all this begins to unfold, David realizes, he said, I deserve what's happening. I mean, that was David's attitude. David, instead of being furious at Absalom and wanting to kill Absalom, David feels like, I've brought all this on myself by what I've done. And so he flees out of Jerusalem and says, maybe God's going to punish me in some terrible way. Maybe he's going to bring me back. I hope he'll have mercy. And so the story goes on, and as you come on down through the story in chapter 16, 17, we find all of the going back and forth, Absalom seeking counsel from Ahithophel and deciding what to do, and so they take off. In chapter 18, David organized the people that were with him and appointed captains. And but notice what David did. Verse 5, he commanded Joab and the others. He said, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave the captains charge concerning Absalom. Going out to battle, and the king, last thing he told the generals, he said, please, deal gently with my son. Well, the story. the men of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and the battle was scattered, and Absalom was trying to get away riding on this mule, and he got caught in the bough of an oak tree. And somebody came and told Joab, said, you know, Absalom's caught over there. And Joab said, well, you saw him. Why didn't you smite him to the ground? What do you mean he's still up over there? I'd have given you a good reward. I'd have given you, I'd have given you a pretty good reward. You'd come back here. And the man told Joab, he said, I don't care if I got 1,000 shekels. Joab said, I'll give you 10. I'd have given you 10 shekels. And the man said, I don't care if you'd given me 1,000 shekels. I'm not going to put forth my hand against the king's son. I heard what he told you, what he told the others. And Joab said, well, I'm not going to stay here with you. Joab went over there, took 3 darts in his hand, thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive. And so Joab killed him. You know, Joab was a hard-headed and sometimes a hard-hearted fellow. He looked at it and he says, this guy is a rebel. He stirred up trouble. He's rebelled against the king. He needs to be killed. The king's too soft-hearted for his own good. That was, see, Joab, if he didn't like the order, he just ignored it and just went charging on. You can appreciate some things about Joab. He was an outstanding military leader. He was a little bit sort of the Douglas MacArthur of his day in some ways. If he was convinced he was right, he was just going to do it his way. And you could argue the point as to whether or not Joab was right in the sense of had the best idea, but the point was that was not what the king had told him to do. So they brought Absalom down, they buried him. And the king was very unhappy. In fact, we're told in verse 33 of chapter 18, the king was much moved, went up to the chamber over the gate, and wept. And as he went, thus he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for you. O Absalom, my son, my son. You know, a very poignant description. Here was a man whose family had in many ways fallen apart. And undoubtedly part of the reason, was Absalom a rebel? Was Absalom a lot of things? Yes, he was. But David looked at it and he felt responsible. And it grieved him to the depth of his soul as to, what had happened with his son. And it certainly goes to show and to illustrate the fact that there are things that no amount of guilt or grief can bring it back and can undo the situation. I think this was the thing that hit David. He had so much guilt about the way he had dealt with the whole situation, all the problems in his family. He felt responsible for it, and it just really hit him hard. And so finally, word got back to Joab. The king was mourning for Absalom, and the victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. This is chapter 19, verse 2. The people heard how the king grieved for his son. And so it was like they were sort of, instead of celebrating the victory, they were all, they were just sort of sneaking away. And the king was going on and on. And verse 5, Joab came to him and sort of talked to him harshly. Told him, verse 6, he said, you love your enemies and hate your friends. You've declared this day that you regard neither princes nor servants. I perceive if Absalom had lived and we had all died, you'd have been happier. Now, he says, you better get up and go out there and speak comfortably to your servants, because I swear by the Lord, if you don't go out there, there's not going to be anybody left here come night. And then you're going to be in worse shape than before this rebellion ever started. Joab talked to him pretty straight. He says, you better pull yourself together and get out there and let people know you appreciate them putting their lives on the line, because you're going to wind up without anybody. Well, the king arose and did what Joab had said. Now the story is... the king coming back. You see, now the king has to be invited back to Jerusalem, and so they go through some of these things, and it gives the account here in chapter 19. And finally, Israel and Judah all invited David back to be the wanted him to come back and reign in Jerusalem. And so he waited, you know, had them actually send a delegation invitation coming back. And the king came back, and they all the king came back to his house in Jerusalem. This is chapter 20, verse 3. And now you read another story. See, old Joab goes to it again, and this time with Amasa. And Amasa had been the other general, and so as you come on down through the story, the king was going to give Joab's job to Amasa, and Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, and so old Joab he doesn't like it. So, verse 9, Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in good health, my brother? And, you know, here, how you feeling?" He sort of put his arm around his shoulder. Next thing you know, he had got him again. And Joab slew him. And Joab killed Amasa. And he expects now to get his old job back. So you know, it's an interesting. So now Joab's over all the host, verse 23. Well, this brings us down to the end of chapter 20. I think it's interesting to look briefly at the strengths and weaknesses of David and the strengths and weaknesses of Joab, two of the main characters in this section. And there's some interesting contrast. And they both have strengths and weaknesses. David had certainly many very positive characteristics, characteristics of faith, of loyalty, of zeal, of wholeheartedness. I think those were some of the most outstanding. There was a humility that David had, which made him open to correction, made him, let's say, malleable, where God could work with him. And all of those were there. David, of course, had failings. His failings seemed to center in terms of his family relationships. He had a weakness for women. There were problems in terms of you know, of his relationship with his children, and he was there were, you know, David was a very emotional person, and that had a strength in terms of his zeal and his wholeheartedness for God, and it also was a weakness in terms of allowing him sometimes to not use his best judgment in terms of his thinking. His feelings wound up being the guiding force, and that could be a problem. But you know, there was a zeal and a loyalty and a faith and a humility that God saw in David, and I think was a key as to why David was such a man after his own heart. Joab was an individual that had great courage, personal bravery. He had a lot of ability. He was very perceptive. Joab was a hard-headed fellow. He had a treacherous streak. You know, that was you crossed him, he'd get you. You know, Joab's, I don't know if he had a bumper sticker on his chariot or not, but if he did, the one he should have had was, "Don't get mad, get even." That was sort of Joab's motto. He got even. And he insisted on doing things his own way. I think that perhaps his greatest failings would be you know, his stubborn insistence on doing things his way, and that treacherous streak that was there of getting even when he felt like that he had somehow been slighted. yet he was a man of tremendous ability. He was the most capable man that David had. In many ways, he was loyal to the king, loyal to what he felt like was best for the king, even when it was contrary to what the king told him to do. It's an interesting person, an interesting mix as you go through this section of Scripture and we look at the character of the individuals. And I think this is it's an important thing because, you know, as you go through and you read a story, you tend to find that there are certain people you identify with more than others. You can easily understand yourself in a particular success or a particular failing because of traits of character. And it's good to go through, to analyze it, to think about it, lessons that you and I can learn personally as we look at all of the characters who play out in this situation. You know, whether it's David, whether it's Joab, whether it's Uriah, whether it's Bathsheba, whether it's Absalom, whether it's Amnon. You go through and you look at all the ones who played major roles. And it's good to go through and to think about it, to analyze it, because the specific situations are maybe different than what we face, but the attitudes and the feelings, the circumstances that people dealt with, and the attitudes and the character traits behind their decisions, are things that show up in all of us. And as we look at things like this and we learn from it, and we see where certain things lead, even though those things may seem justifiable at the moment, when we see where it leads, we have that's where meditation comes in Bible study. You read an account, but meditation is when you turn it over in your mind and you try to derive lessons from it you can apply in your own life, and you think about it. And in that way, we derive lessons of life that we can benefit from now and on out. Well, that completes this section that we were on here this evening. And next Bible study, we're going to finish up this closing part of 2 Samuel and go on through the death of David and the reign of King Solomon. So we'll pick that up next Bible study.